You know what COVID has done? It has literally made liars of us all. Why do I say that? Because for the longest time in our lives, we always say, if we had the time, we would do this, do that, right? That's our go-to excuse. I'll get out of jail free card. If I had the time, I would learn a new instrument or pick up a new language, something, you know, clean the house, you know, whatever. But now with COVID, especially during the circuit breaker, we have all the time in the world. How come you never realize any of your dreams?
Hi, this is Eric here, and you're listening to
Hashtag Highly Sought After.
Have you ever thought of starting your own home-based food business or maybe even set up your own hawker store or restaurant? If you secretly say yes, you must listen to this episode twice. My guest today was one of the top five finalists in the MasterChef series here in Singapore. Last year, during the COVID pandemic, he launched his very first hawker store selling bee hoon kueh, and it became a hawker sensation here in Singapore. Long queues, food sell by 1 to 2pm, raving reviews from top local food bloggers. And as of this interview, he has already opened 4 more stores with 2 more on its way. So there's a lot we can learn from him on how we can market our food brand. So, Aaron, I got
a difficult question.
I'm good. I just ate your bee hoon kueh.
Really?
Yes. Fresh bee hoon kueh.
How is it? Don't say just because I'm here.
No, honestly, I wouldn't say that. It was really good. And I'll tell you why. Because number one, I'm biased. Bee hoon kueh is one of my favorite dishes.
That's great.
But number two is I like that it's very fresh. That, you know, you order already, right? Then the person will take
you do it on the spot.
You're doing it on the spot, right? Yeah. And I like that meatball.
That meatball, there's a lot of love in it. It's just like, I mean, a lot of guys, when they have meatballs, they have a lot of fillers.
Yeah.
They add all kinds of like flour and all that. Ours is just meat and nothing else. Plus seasoning, of course.
And that prawn ball.
Oh, that one was 100% prawn. Okay, plus seasoning.
Yeah, but it kind of reminds you of the very atas Hai Di Lao.
It is.
Oh, you modeled that.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Because we always order the prawn thingy that is very expensive, $30+.
It's almost exactly the same thing.
So, okay, guys, we have just... by the way, there's going to be B-roll for that. We took videos of the food just now, earlier that we ate.
Great. You should have told me if you were coming.
No. We didn't want to. We just want to come and support.
Okay.
But I have to say that... Okay, first, let me start a difficult question or a fun question for you. If you were to describe yourself with a dish, what would you
myself
use as a dish? Yeah.
I mean, it's coming to me almost immediately. I don't know if it's right, but I'll say rojak.
Rojak, why?
Because it's a mix of everything. I mean, I'm a photographer.
Mm.
I'm a commercial photographer, so I do advertising stuff and all that. And I'm a professional diver, which is actually completely different already. And then now I'm doing, you know, all this F&B stuff, which, you know, nothing kind of fits, but I just enjoy them all. So, nothing. It's not one fixed thing. So it's just a jumbo of everything thrown together, mix it in a pot and see what
and
comes out.
And the sweet sauce is what? Passion?
Yeah, probably, you know, and see what comes out the other end, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm.
I love that answer.
Yeah, it's a bit crazy. Yeah.
You know, I was looking at all your videos and all, right? What really stood out for me was that you said you're self-taught.
Almost everything.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, yeah, almost everything.
So, like, what was the very first dish do you still remember cooking?
I won't say the first dish, but maybe the first dish I could remember being good at.
Yeah.
Is just this oyster chicken. Sesame oil chicken.
Yeah. In a clay pot.
But it's mostly oyster sauce. So it's one pot, chicken wing, you know, a lot of meat wings. And then, I mean, it's very difficult to mess that one up, but that's probably why I did it so well. Then I remember that's one of the first few dishes that I could technically feed people with. Nobody died.
Why do you think that was your best dish at that point? Is it because you follow a certain recipe or
my grandfather actually. My grandfather, he's Hainanese, right? So, you know, a Hainanese man cook one. So my first image of anybody standing in the kitchen, the whole concept of cooking, you know, how food go from meat to a dish, is looking at my granddad. I mean, when you're a kid, when you go to a hawker center, you don't see people cook, right?
Yeah,
you the food just arrives. But my whole, you know, concept of seeing someone put a dish together is actually my granddad. And he cooks a lot. And this is one of his stuff. The other one is, of course, lu rou fan. So you see where he's going. It's always this very gravy.
Very savory.
Yeah, correct. Very
gravy.
A lot of lor the kind of stuff, like black soy sauce.
Saucy.
Yeah, correct. His kind of stuff. So I'm very influenced by that. So I make the chicken wing very well. I started with that. And then I did the lu rou fan also. The lor ba.
Great. Let me explain, because we have people not from Singapore, right? So lu rou fan, It's like
braised pork belly.
Yes, braised pork belly with a lot of rice and a lot of brown sauce.
Yeah, it's very a lot of duck gravy. I mean, It's a lot of lard in it. It's a lot of skin, but it's very, very tender. It falls off the bone kind of tender.
I forgot to do a disclaimer just now at the intro that you should never listen to this episode. If you're hungry. If you're hungry in the middle of the night.
Kids, don't watch this when you're hungry or, you know.
Yeah, don't. You need to. Listen to us while you're eating your roll fan and your lunch. So, Aaron, you joined season one of MasterChef. Season one, you know. Wow. It's not...
Pioneer.
Yeah, you're the pioneer. Yeah. How did it happen? Like, do you always knew that you would join MasterChef one day?
I'll be totally honest, not at all, right? It was more or less like one thing led to the other, another kind of situation. Because first of all, it was season one. So it was a big thing. Everybody, finalists in Singapore. And everybody's talking about it. And I was having a drink literally with some friends. And it just popped on one of my feet. Right? And then my friend's saying like, hey, dude, you need to go. You know, why don't you try it out? And he says that because I'm the food guy within the group.
Yeah.
You know, in a group of friends, you always have the guy who books the movie tickets. You have the guy who organizes stuff, the guy who brings the booze. I'm the guy who takes care of the food, right? So
always need a friend like that.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So you always get one guy who's like, food, he'll take care of it. If you want to go watch a movie, this guy is going to buy the tickets, you know? It's always unsaid rule. So I'm the food guy and naturally they say, you know, dude, why don't you just give it a shot? And then I thought about it. We were having drinks. I'm like, I know what, forget it. And then I thought about it a bit more and they made the entire application process quite simple. You know, you just basically sign on, like fill in your name. This is the first round. And then send, I know what's the worst that can happen, right? It's free. And then I think a couple of weeks or maybe a week or two later, they gave me sent me another email saying, we'd like to know you more. And then that's where they asked for more information, you know, your social media. They want to see who you are, what you represent. And then I thought, still, you know, what can I lose, right?
Yeah.
So sent that over. And then it was the second or third correspondence. And then finally got very real when they asked you down for an interview.
Okay.
And I'm like, you know, this shit is really happening, right? Yeah. So I'll be honest, I'm thinking of like, now this is getting real. I don't even know if I want to do it, you know, to be very honest. Yeah. Because
like the whole Singapore will be looking at you.
Yeah. Like, do you want to put yourself out there? Because I'm not a chef, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, I cook at home for friends. What do I know about, you know, cooking for others? And I mean, if you watch the show, you know, I'm not a fan of fancy food. You know, I'm just a local boy.
Mm.
So what do I know about this elevated, you know, restaurant level stuff? And on top of that, it was quite a commitment. It was over 3 weeks commitment, like at a go, right? So you need to fall off the surface of this planet for 3 weeks. And we didn't have our phones. If you want to know, I mean...
Yeah, they don't allow you to
record. Fun facts. Fun fact about MasterChef is you're not allowed to have your phone. So for a lot of reasons, you know, secrecy and all the NDAs, you know, non-disclosure, and it's very serious. Technically, you can't have a life for 3 weeks. So whatever you have planned, you know, you have to put it to a halt. I mean, some of my fellow contestants actually quit their job just to be on MasterChef.
Yeah,
because there's no other way you could do it. But I guess that step is important because it weeds out all the not committed ones.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, they just try.
Correct,
you know?
Let's go for fun, you know. So they really want to make sure, no, listen, if you want to come in, you need to be very serious. And so I did. And I mean, the rest is history. Like,
I'm very curious, like, what was the interview process? Like, you said that they invited you down. Was it just a Q&A or they make you cook something on the spot?
Okay, I will tell you, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but I think it's fine. You know, I think it's fine. So basically the interview, the audition, right, is they make you cook a dish in a setting that is very similar to the show, not the real one. And then there are cameras. I don't think they're rolling because I'm in this industry. I know I'm a photographer. The cameras are not rolling, right? But the cameras are there. And then there are people asking all the time a lot of questions. And all that, like, you know, what are you doing now? Can you explain while you are doing this? And you have 1 hour to prepare a dish of your choice. Right? So that's the easy part. You can do whatever you want to do. And of course, you need to impress them with the dish. Of course, it needs to be good. And also they want to see how you work on TV. You know, can you deliver the lines and all that? And then a lot of process, then we had to go for medical and all that, you know, to make sure you have
fit for the show.
Yeah, and mentally sound. I'm not even joking. A psych evaluation, whether you can handle the stress and all that kind of stuff. So because it's a really serious cook show.
It's like the Olympics for the cooking world.
And everything, I mean, if there's any, you know, I know the folks at home watching this, they want to know if how real this is. I'll tell you now, as a matter of fact, that everything you see on the show is real. Right, so we only know what we're going to cook at the exact moment.
Do you get to go home or you have to stay in some
kind
of hostel?
We get to go home. Okay. We get to go home for Singapore show, but I mean, other like the Australian ones, I know for a fact they have to stay in a hotel together. But Singapore being the size we are, we go home. So you have no idea what they're going to throw at you and you have no reference of anything. It means you don't have your phone, you don't have any notes that you can bring in. You technically must know everything, right? If I want to say, buddy, I want you to bake a cake. You have to bake at least one cake. You need to know one of everything. If I want you to make a curry, you make a curry. And I'm not talking about tear open some ready mix.
Yeah, instant mix.
Yeah, and pour some coconut. No, man, make
from
a curry.
Scratch.
That's the galangal. That's the ginger. And here are some turmeric, you know?
Gosh.
Then you got to pound and make a curry, like how curry is supposed to be made. You need to know one of everything.
So may I know how you prepared for that? So first of all, when you got selected, right? Mm-hmm. So they emailed you or something. Mm-hmm. What was your first emotion?
Yeah. Again, I was saying maybe I don't want to do it. Then I realized, wow, this is one out of, I have one slot out of 20, you know, out of the whole Singapore who got it. If I don't do well or I'm not putting my heart and soul into this, right? It's actually depriving someone else of this opportunity.
Exactly. Wow, well said.
So I'm thinking, okay, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to make sure I try.
Yes.
But then I'm this abeng local boy, you know. I mean, I don't even know anything about let's talk about French food, right? Like, what do I know about all this?
Yeah.
You know, but my contestants are, the rest of my fellow contestants, they're very different. They're really into it. They're, you know, they know all the names of everything. And I'm just thinking, I'm not going to do well in this, you know. But then I felt maybe this would have been a good opportunity to showcase we are about as Singaporeans,
fantastic,
right?
Fantastic. Like,
just do our version of everything, like, you know, we try our best. Then again, is this mentality of, you know, what's the worst that can happen?
Hey, and I just want to plug something in. I read on the internet, right, that our dear friend Aaron was actually number one in the first challenge.
Yes.
So don't pray, ha. Okay, he might not be like a professional chef or what, but he makes Singaporeans proud because you show local food, right?
Yeah, I can feel this in a little bit. Actually, I was the top scorer of the entire show because they had, I think, a total of 8 episodes, if I remember correctly. 8 episodes. I was in 6 of them. I won 5 of the challenges. So, and it was in a row. So it became very stressful.
Yes, I wanted to ask you that. How do you feel? Like, everybody's watching you.
It's very crazy because the first one was nice because like, ooh, look at this. And then the second one was like, oh, this is pretty good. I'm on a roll.
Yeah.
And then the third and fourth and then winning all the team challenges, you know, Twitter kind of exploded. I didn't even have a Twitter account, I'll be honest. I don't know what it's about. Like, I know what Twitter is, but I just don't like it. It's not my generation.
What do you mean by you say Twitter exploded? What people are talking about?
Yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. So they say, oh, this guy's going to win. So then there's all this pressure, you know. And then, of course, during the show, it is still a competition. The contestants, we are still very good friends. We love each other to death.
Oh, nice.
Up to now, we still meet up in our houses, different houses, and we hang out, we have potluck and all that before COVID, of course.
Oh, wouldn't I kill to be with one of those potluck? Can you imagine, guys? All our MasterChef.
Yeah, the insane amount of food. Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
But we were never, you know, like trying to dig each other's eyeballs out, none of that. But there is still a competitive element in the air.
Good, okay.
So it's stressful, you know, you win one or two, then you know, everybody eyes on you, cameras on you. Then you feel like almost you can't fail, you know?
Yeah, how do you feel? How do you mentally prepare for that show then?
Honestly, after a few days of filming, I just realized the best way to prepare for this is to not prepare seriously. Because
I believe a lot of students have the same philosophy.
Yeah, because if you are still thinking about it, if it's going to start filming, you can't possibly prepare for something.
You don't even know, right?
Yeah, that you don't know what's going to happen. And I feel that if you keep trying to think of what you can do. And then when the challenge comes, you will try to tailor that challenge to fit something you already know. You get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you overdo it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say that, and that's not humble bragging or what, but you must have a certain talent, right? Because for you not to know what to cook and you are able to emerge, is it because you have a lot of experience in cooking or you really just have a flair for it?
I just a bit of flair, I think. And I think you need to have that to be in a show like this.
Wait, when you say flair, what? Your communication skills kind of flair? Like you have very good showmanship or like the way you do your food is different?
I think just the cooking part. Yeah, the cooking part. I mean, for me, maybe it was a little bit easier because I'm used to cameras. So because I'm a photographer. I mean, being in a studio, being in this setting here is my home, you know. I know all this equipment, right? So when I got to, here's a funny story. When I got to the set of MasterChef, there's so many crew, right? Because there's something like 12 cameras rolling at one go. And when some of the crew saw me, I know these guys, I work with them. Like, hey bro, you covering steels today? And no, I'm not covering steels. I'm bloody contestant. Shit, no way.
Oh.
So funny because I work with this guy. So it's very natural for me.
Yeah.
So when the filming starts, you know, it goes, and stand by, action. You know, everybody, boom, cameraman running around. I'm sure it's quite nerve-wracking for some of the fellow contestants
correct.
Who are not used to these things.
Correct.
So I guess there's a bit of an advantage there. But short of that, like your question was like, how do I prepare? So I just don't because I gave up. I realized that I keep thinking, wow, if I have a chicken, I'll do this. Then when you have that challenge,
yep.
and the challenge will usually not be a product, a kind of protein. It's like, oh, do this. But because you're so focused on chicken or whatever that is, then you just want to tailor it into a chicken, you know? And then when you go into the pantry, you don't even know if there's going to be chicken in the pantry.
So you kind of set us out to fail.
Correct. So yeah, exactly. So you're still tunnel vision because you prepared too much.
And you prevent yourself from being creative. Because
exactly.
a lot of times it's in the flow,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, you boxed yourself in without knowing it.
This is beautiful stuff. Yeah. Were there any memorable moments in that five episode you were in?
A lot, man. I mean, the first one is probably like you mentioned, the first win. I mean, because that was the point that tipped the scale, right? Because prior, everything that happened before that was, I think I'm pretty good. I like what I cook. But hey, what the hell do I know about what's nice? Maybe I'm wrong. But all my friends say it's nice. But then again, they are my friends. Family say they are nice too. But again, that's family. So to feed experts, you know, like judges, how is it going to fare? So when you win the first one, I think that gives a vote of confidence. And you may feel like, ah, okay, all right, now we're talking, you know, like, oh, I can actually do this.
Yes.
So that's that. If you ask me that pivotal moment, that kind of
assurance.
All, yeah, exactly. Then, of course, the rest of the memories are really the behind the scenes stuff with the fellow contestants, which I told you, we are still very, very good friends. And a lot of times I know for a fact that the producers and all the directors want some drama. But unfortunately, we are not the US version where we want to dig each other's eyeballs out. Yeah. You know, we are just very mellow and very love.
Like,
you know?
Okay, oh, you don't cook this. Like, Zema,
after that, we are not bickering about anything. We are going in and giving each other a lot of encouragement, you know. It's completely different from what I said.
Very wholesome.
Exactly.
Very wholesome episode.
Yeah, but it's very twisted because you know, for every challenge that you go in, you're going to come back with one guy less.
Yeah.
It's like Squid Game, man. You know what I mean? Like,
my God,
yeah,
you're right.
It's like, your friends, but you know going in there that my main job is to make sure you don't come back, right? So that's the messed up, but that's
reality, right? I mean, life is like that too, right? How do you feel when you were at rank 5, right? If I recall, how do you feel? Like, everybody is rooting for you to win this whole thing.
When I got eliminated?
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you, I'm not trying to be sore about it, but I think that was the best way to get eliminated. I'll explain why, because...
Okay.
I won so many of the challenges.
Yes.
Before.
And it's consecutive.
Yeah. But because of one very simple reason, because I don't follow rules, right? Because who says it must be like that? Well, to begin with, I don't even know the rules because I didn't go to any culinary school, right? I didn't know I was doing it wrong.
Yeah. Aaron is self-taught that, by the way.
Yeah.
Guys.
So if it's sweet, it's sweet. If it's nice, it's nice. Who cares how it was made, right? So not following the rules, the rebel, yada, yada. And then came that challenge. And that challenge is a replication challenge. So, what they basically did is they give you a recipe book. Never read a recipe book in my life, right? I'm not even joking. I watch YouTube, right?
You don't, you'll go agaration and...
Yeah, I don't own a single recipe book. I'm saying this in front of the camera. I don't own one, right? So I watch YouTube or how to do this. I mean, I'd rather somebody tell me how it works than I'm reading half a cup of this, you know, 3 measures of that, like, shit, who gives a, you know, right? So then this challenge came with a serious recipe book. I'm like, oh shit,
GG.
Yeah, that's I'm right here, man. So I wasn't able to follow a very clean, all the items measured for you. All you need to do is put it in order as per what the recipe says. How can you mess this up? But I just can't do it.
Wow. Now I understand why you say that in some way, it's actually a very nice way to exit.
Exactly.
Because your brand is a rebel. You go by your feelings.
Yeah.
And the episode essentially, I mean, naturally you fail, right?
Because
you don't follow rules.
Yeah, correct. Because I just follow who I was. I mean, in hindsight, of course, I wish I did a better job. But because when they say, okay, your time starts now and the clock starts moving, all your strategy and all that goes to hell because all of a sudden you're in the moment. So you naturally just do what you are good at doing.
Yeah.
At some point, you would
go back to that default.
Yeah, correct. Go back to that default setting. And I would just... it's just silly lah, but it's good fun.
No, it's great. It was great, nice, entertaining watching you.
It's a very nice way to end up, sum up the whole thing. And now we had to apologize to Singapore. Sorry guys.
Why apologize? I don't get it.
Because there's a lot of people, man.
They're disappointed,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, because so many of us were rooting for you.
I mean, there are kids watching this show that wants me to win. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry I messed up your dreams.
No. So 2018 was that competition.
Correct.
Right? Then you started your very first store.
Last year.
So there was a gap of 2 years. What were you doing after you left MasterChef?
Okay, right after the show, there were a lot of people wanting to collab.
Yeah,
yeah,
correct.
And then there were endorsements and all that stuff. But in the end of the day, I'm still a photographer, right? That's my job, my studio, my business. I've been a photographer for 22 years at a time, right? So I realized that I'm not going to do anything else, right? But I did do a few pop-ups and all that in restaurants, collaborations with other chefs. So, you know, I went through the entire process doing all the fine dining stuff, big plate, very small food, wow, very pretty, take one tweezer.
Then was like that.
Yeah, then was, I did that all, you know what I mean? Like, you know, customer sitting right in front of you, watching you do every little thing and wear a chef jacket, you know, atas until, wow, your name on it.
Yeah.
But I just didn't like it. And I just, again, no offense to these guys who do all this. I mean, they're all masters, but it's just not my stuff.
Yeah, it's
right?
Not you.
I just feel that food should be very honest. It shouldn't be so fluffed up and so wayang, you know. Just it is what it is. It should be kept simple. And I'm a local, but I like this kind of local flavors. That's it. So I tried a few of that. I didn't like it. So I stopped there. And so I wasn't expecting to do anything until COVID, you know.
So COVID was a trigger?
Yes. Well, I read some. I don't know if I read somewhere or watched it somewhere. Okay, but it came from somebody else. So I'm just saying, I am paraphrasing here. I'm just using someone's line, okay? You know what COVID has done? It has literally made liars of us all. Why do I say that? Because for the longest time in our lives, we always say, if we had the time, we would do this, do that, right? That's our go-to excuse. I'll get out of jail free card. If I had the time, I would learn a new instrument or pick up a new language, something, you know, clean the house, you know, whatever. But now with COVID, especially during the circuit breaker, we have all the time in the world. How come you never realize any of your dreams?
Oh, good one.
Yeah. So you've been lying to yourself all this while, because all the time I'm saying, I'm busy making money, shooting, you know, I'm going to make a living, you think the petrol free, yeah? You know, I'm going to pay the house, and blah, 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 blah. You know, I'm going to F&B, okay, like, if really all else fails, I've got, if I have the time, okay, I would open a hawker store, right? And then now, you know, COVID slaps you with all the time you need. Then I'm thinking, you know, if not now, then quite frankly, when? Yeah. And I know a lot of people saying, you know, COVID, you know, it's also uncertain and all that. It is uncertain in F&B in general, but it depends on which sector you're talking about. If you're in the restaurant business, then seriously, guys, they're having a really hard time.
Yeah.
Okay, it's really difficult. And I understand completely. But if you're talking about like what I'm saying in the hawker, you know, food and, you know, coffee shops and all that, those are staple, you know, that's the backbone of the industry. And I hope, touch wood
here.
Yeah. I don't see how we will stop having hawker food.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You get what I'm saying? We can't close it down, because if there comes a day where a hawker or coffee shop has to close down.
Yeah. We lose a very big part of our identity.
No, as in like, we will be, that's it, man, bro, end game. Right? Think about it. Restaurants close down, yes. Cannot dine in, yes. But if there comes a day, they have to shut down all the food centers, means people cannot eat already, no? Correct or not?
Yeah.
That is very serious. That is literally Lee Hsien Loong will probably go on TV and say, don't argue, just go home and be with your families.
Gosh, it's probably apocalypse.
Yeah, it's apocalypse. By the time the most basic source of food has to be shut down, then we are in a lot of trouble. And by then, nothing will really matter, would it?
Yeah,
so
true.
Okay, in some ways, being a hawker is a really secure sector of F&B. It's not doing as good as it was before, but then again, I don't think it will ever die.
Yeah.
Because that is sustenance.
Right? I agree. And you think about it, like the period of time where we cannot go out and eat, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird. There's no more reason to go out, because we go out to eat.
Correct.
You know, and then we lose that part of us. But I'm very curious, like, so I get why hawker, we'll talk a lot about the hawker culture and, you know, your vision as well for the hawker industry.
Mm-hmm.
But why bee hoon kueh? By the way, we have to explain to our viewers not from Singapore, right? What is bee hoon kueh? Can we try?
Bee hoon kueh is basically, Asian pasta.
You are good.
Think about it, right?
Yeah.
Just minus the egg, right? It's just flour and water. It originated as a peasant food, right? Because it's very basic. You know, our forefathers came across from China and they had flour, they had water. They had some anchovies, you know, we call them ikan bilis, and small little fried fillers. And then they just cook some basic soup and then give you a lot of carbs, because they need to work, right? They are all working in the dogs, coolies, and all kinds of stuff. So a lot of energy. So they had to load the carbs in. So flour, right? Make noodles. And then instead of cooling these noodles, which requires skill, they just roll it down. The original traditional mee hoon kueh is a ball of dough and they literally pinch it out. It's actually more lumpy than what we are doing now. Ours, of course, we roll it through a pasta machine and then we tear it by hand still. So we are still very close to original, just slightly more consistent. Mm. So that's what it is. It's hand-torn pasta, Asian version.
I love that. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm going to tell all my foreign friends that it's like, that's
the Asian kuih. Version.
The Asian version. Okay.
Chinese pasta. Yeah.
So why this Asian version?
First of all, I like it. So it's, to me, it's a meal that I enjoy.
High five. Okay. Yeah, agree.
Because I don't think you can cook something with passion if you don't bloody like it.
True.
Okay. You can say all you want, but I think that's at least the baseline you need to have. As for why, I mean, but then again, I like a lot of other food. Okay. But mi hun kuih falls into this category of comfort food. But then again, I also have a lot of other comfort food. But mi hun kuih actually is one of the more unique ones. Think about it. Because I do a very solid wonton mee, for example. Mm. And the luro fan, for example. Noodles, yeah, all this stuff.
Braised pork rice.
Correct. Yeah. But if you look at wonton, the dumpling noodles, it's very common. The market is saturated with it. There is one in every single hawker center you go to. Period. Right? But if you talk about mi hun kuih, I would say a more specialized mi hun kuih store, you don't really get much. I think that really maybe you can count in with five hands certain brands, right?
Yeah, correct.
I'm not going to say the brands, but that few. Yes, you can get mi hun kuih at a lot of other places, but they are always, oh, by the way, we have mi hun kuih. It's like fish soup, ban mian.
Yeah, it's not like you go somewhere just to have mi hun kuih. Right,
exactly. So mi hun kuih sometimes feels like it's almost like an afterthought. You know, if I have ban mian, I have this, oh, by the way, I have mi hun kuih too. But they're not specialized. So to have a specialized mi hun kuih store, a little bit more unique.
You know, I think right at the start of the episode, I talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. We felt that it would be very weird if we don't try a bihun kuih before the interview. Right? Yeah. And I felt like, no, I have bihun kuih in my tummy right now. It's a very wholesome, very homely kind of food.
Especially the weather today.
Today, cooling weather, right?
Yeah, bihun kuih weather.
Soup. So guys, if you're listening to this episode, go get it, okay? So let's do a quick plugged in first before we talk a bit about your business. Where are they? Where can we find them? By the way, the name of your hawker store, it's called Jiak Song, which is Hokkien, right? It's a dialect. Mm. So would you like to tell us what is Jiak Song?
Jiak Song is, like what you mentioned, Jiak is basically eat, right? Okay. Song is a Singapore slang. Shook, you know, is strong.
Feels good.
So it feels good. So it's to loosely, lamely translate it, it's like it feels good after eating.
Ah, so guys, if you want to feel good about
your
food.
So it's Jiak Song, JIAKSONG.
Go try that.
Mi hun kuih. We have 4 outlets. We have the original one in Telok Blangah Crescent.
And you might actually end up seeing Aaron because he stays around there.
Yeah. I don't want to list out the entire address. I can't remember anyway as well. Yeah. But just Google Jiak Song Mi hun kuih Telok Blangah.
Yeah.
Or Jiak Song Mi hun kuih Bedok. Or Jiak Song Mi hun kuih Tampines. Or Jiak Song Mi hun kuih Queen Street.
Wait. Queen Street, where is that?
That's Bugis. It is Bugis, but the actual
the
street...
The one that we just went. Okay.
Yeah, correct. But the actual name is... The street is Queen Street.
Queen Street, which is at Bugis. Okay, not fair. What's happening to the north, which is where I stay, and what's happening to the west? Are you going to do something for those two places?
We are coming soon.
Yes! North to her.
Yeah. I'm looking, but it's interesting because especially, okay, since we are talking about this.
Yes.
One thing that you guys also want to know is that to get into a hawker store.
How's it like?
It requires a bit of work because not only must you find the right place, the right location, the right traffic, price must be right. More importantly, the store must not have something that's conflicting.
So
a lot of my friends are like, oh, when are you coming to this? Yeah, I would like to, but it's so difficult to find the right spot. Because if that particular hawker store has anything close to a ban mian, you know, or yu tang, you know, fish soup, the owners of that coffee shop might not want you to come in.
I see. Okay. They don't want to antagonize
their
hawker. Okay.
So guys, if you want to come into the hawker industry and you want to do wonton mee, right? For example, dumpling noodles, char siu, all this.
Forget it.
It's very difficult.
No, but I'll do my job. That means, you see, okay, so very simple, guys. Those of you listening or watching, right? You want, especially the local Singaporeans, you want Jiak Song to be with you. You help him also, right? Start looking out for locations that doesn't have a bihun kuih store. Yes. We just text you or you just inform me. I'll inform
Drop
Aaron.
Us a note in one of in our IG.
I'll pay attention.
Yeah.
I'll pay attention to that. And I really have to, okay, I'll address the local scene in a short while. I have a lot to say about the local scene, but I have a question for you, right? Aaron, you are a hawker sensation. There are super long queues. We have to come earlier just so that we don't run out of bihun kuih. Bihun kuih runs out at 2:00, you know, sometimes even earlier. I read the food bloggers and I know some of them, they're very legit, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that they get paid, you know, they really say it's good.
Yeah.
What's your secret sauce?
$2 million and we can talk. Hey! No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the bloggers coming in. I'm just going to put it on the record now. As of this recording, I have not paid anybody to come.
No, exactly.
So,
yeah.
They show up without even me knowing. Sometimes I don't even know when they came. Somebody just tagged me. Hey, look, you have been featured. And I didn't even see them. Or maybe they didn't even come themselves. They have their writers. Came. Bless their heart. Thank you very much for that one. The secret sauce, I think the difference between my mee hoon kueh and the traditional ones, right? I mean, for the overseas friends, it's usually a very clean soup, right? Mee hoon kueh is very clean, but it's always just soup.
Yeah.
Ikan bilis, soya bean, then some pork bone, depending on if it's a fish-based or pork-based soup. But it's always very clean and very light. My mee hoon kueh is a little bit more robust, as you've tried. It's somewhere in between a mee hoon kueh and ramen.
Yeah, very unami. Is that how you say umami?
Umami, yeah.
Umami, very savory.
Yes, so it's got a lot of stuff in it. A lot of the inspiration of how I assemble this dish happened during one of the many trips I've been to Japan. And I got inspired because, I mean, who are we to argue with the Japanese about ramen, right? You know what I mean? These guys are, I mean, they have the most Michelin star in the world per country, right? So they must be doing something right. I mean, they came out with umami in the first place, right? Yes. Who are we to argue with these guys? So I actually learned a lot of stuff and got some ideas from them. And so the mee hoon kueh is different in that aspect. It's no longer a soup, it's a broth. It's thick. And of course, it's got a lot of good ingredients.
Yes.
And the secret, of course, there's another thing that a lot of people rave about is this wok hei that's inside.
How do we explain that? Wok hei, it's burnt.
Char. It's like the smokiness. I mean, you get this only in a really Chinese stir fry.
Yes.
Friends from the West or overseas, don't confuse it with barbecue smoke. It's different. It's not like cherry wood or the kind of hickory kind of smoke. It's the kind of char you get out of a very strong fire as you stir fry in a big wok, that kind of stuff. So I don't know if you notice there's a bit of that. It's not overpowering, it's there, but you can't really figure out where it came from, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Wow. Now, food aside, obviously, having good food is very important, right? Is there any other factors that is very important when it comes to marketing your food brand?
Marketing the food brand. Mm.
Because you can be very good if people don't know about it, no point, right?
I think in this climate, right, this time and age, of course, social media is very, very important. But step one, of course, you got to have that good product. Mm. You got to make sure your food is good. Then how you want to market it, how you want to brand it, you need to be able to create that look first, you know what I mean? Like what you want, like think of a nice catchy name like Jiasong, for example, you know? How do you want to engage your so-called customers? Yep. Then you have all your social media stuff. So get all that ready. Of course, for me, I'm fortunate MasterChef did help. I can't deny, right? It does help.
What do you mean by it does help?
Because of the brand, right?
Oh, as in like because you were in MasterChef, you already have the brand. Okay.
Correct. But that is also can be a double-edged sword, you know? It can be the Achilles heel because you can entice people to come and try first because of the MasterChef brand.
Yeah.
Like, oh, MasterChef opened this soy. And then you draw the people. But if your product is not good, it backfires very, very quickly.
Even more. People laugh more. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of that, you are very judged.
Mm.
Right? They will be extremely picky, even more picky than they would
with
anybody
normal,
else.
Because they say you've been through MasterChef.
Yeah, so they nitpick on every little thing. So if you ask me, it's a double-edged sword. But if you don't have the MasterChef thing and you're thinking how you want to create that brand, first of all, spend a bit of time in social media, you know, build up a small little, at least a nice page, get some followers going, manage your social media accounts properly, and then give people a lot of content to read about, and then, you know, draw these people in. But in the end of the day, I think you need to really let the food do the talking.
Would you say that the photos help? Taking nice pictures of your food?
Of course. I think it does. I mean, I shot all the photos.
Yeah. I mean, that's an unfair advantage, right? Because you're a commercial photographer.
Yeah. So I shoot all that. So you know, I designed the entire look.
Yeah, I want to ask you that. What's the thought process behind the store decor and all the utensils and visuals?
Mm-hmm. Just old, no school like the old school, bro.
Wow,
yeah. It's designed, you went to the one in Queen Street to really get the feel of the DNA of
your brand.
The brand, you must go to Telok Blangah.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Because that is the flagship. That shop is legit, right? It is really made of real wood, you know. And the whole creative direction was it's supposed to look like a push cart. You know, those old push carts with a glass cabinet.
Yes.
And then one big pot of soup. Yeah. You know, that's how we used to sell stuff. And then there's a small little pressure lamp, you know, yeah. And back in the day, it's like if you turn it on, means business starts, right? And it's very straightforward. It's just mee hoon kueh. There's no fancy cartoon, nothing. It's just one word. It says what it says. you see it from a mile away. So that was the look. But of course, the whole vintage look is just the frontage, the facade, right? When you step in it, it's actually a professional kitchen, right? All the state-of-the-art stuff, up-to-date stuff, I would call it, right? There's no open flame in the entire shop. Insulated boilers, you know, induction cookers and all this stuff. And a proper restaurant kitchen workflow. Yeah.
I see. So there's also another advantage of yours or something different, right?
Right.
Got it. Okay. So we need to definitely get some pictures and videos of the vintage one.
The vintage
one. You can look at it.
Because the one that you saw in Bugis, we have a lot of restrictions because of the coffee shops themselves. They want to have certain look maintained. And of course, wood, you know, they just like, oh, we don't want to use wood. It's, you know, it gets wet and all that stuff. So there's a lot of red tape that we can't cross.
But it's very clear that the image that you're trying to bring across is something a bit more old school.
Yes,
you're trying to bring a dish that we all like when we're young and to be as authentic as possible, right?
Exactly.
So that's the image that you want to create. So I guess to answer back that, to circle back the question on how do you market it, I guess for all food brands, they need to start thinking about what's the emotions that they want to generate when people eat their food. Mm. Maybe that would be a very good guide, do you think?
I mean, to be very honest, when I went into this, right, the social media marketing stuff or any form of marketing for that matter was the last thing on my mind.
Wow.
Not that I don't want to do it, but I simply didn't have the time to look into it. Mm. Because we were opening the first store and I have, you know, I'm flustered and I'm like, oh shit, you know, panicked and like, oh, now we have to talk about so much food. How am I going to do this? Blah, blah, blah. And you just don't have the time. But again, fortunately for me, because of the MasterChef tag, right, a lot of people just, I mean, media outlets, they just basically picked us
up. Curious, yeah.
And they just started posting. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, now I have to really quickly share this post and do all this stuff. But I honestly didn't have time. Because when we started, I was doing 16 hours a day, hardcore.
Wow.
Right? So by the end of the day, I don't care what you are. La. I mean, I'm in production, I'm in the filming industry. I always felt that production crew are some of the toughest people, right?
Yeah.
Until I met the people in F&B.
Oh.
I mean, pound for pound, these guys really, you're talking about 12 hours of standing.
Non-stop standing under the heat.
Under the heat. I mean, no more Father's Day for you, bro, because it's so hot, right? I mean, you don't even have to cook. If I draw a yellow box and I get you to stand in there for 12 hours, don't do anything, just stand straight.
Yeah.
I'll give you water anytime you want, but just stand straight. Don't lean on nothing.
It's still a torture.
12 hours is a long time to stand.
Yeah, it is.
So imagine these guys doing all this. So I was doing 16-hour days when we started. But I guess in any business, when you start off, the good old elbow grease is required. There's no shortcuts to that stuff. So I wasn't thinking that much of it. But now I am. So I try my best to, you know, update a little bit of stuff, listen to what people are saying, share some of these things. But in the end of the day, I think I spend more effort making sure the food is up to standard.
There's a saying, right? That be so good at what you do, the world loses its breath watching you do what you do.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I hope that comes true for me in some ways. Yeah.
Maybe yours is what? Be so good at what you do, right? People ask for a second serving.
There we go.
That'll be best on business.
There
right?
we go. There we go.
What if someone comes to you now, right? A young guy? Because there are a lot of young entrepreneurs who want to demo in the F&B. And I noticed something very interesting that these young people do not mind setting up their store at a hawker.
Because,
you know, during my generation, I'm from the 80s, right? Like, huh? I mean, I work in a hawker center for my cousins as well. Mm. It's a very tiring job. But I noticing young people setting up Western food stores, setting up pasta stores at a hawker.
Yes.
And even beer at hawker. What's happening in this whole hawker scene?
Yes. Okay, these are very interesting times, like, to be honest, especially in this COVID and all that. Just before this pandemic, the hawker culture is obviously having some problems.
Yeah, shaky.
Because the truth is, more people are retiring. The old guards are retiring more than young ones are taking over.
Correct.
That was what's happening. And then all these people are talking about reinventing hawker food. You hear that all the time. Oh, we want to reinvent hawker food.
Wait, the young people saying that?
Yeah, the young people. Mm. Now, don't get me wrong. I think it's okay. However, I don't think that is what I want to do because it's not the food that needs to reinvent. It's the way we make this food that needs to change. Okay? It's the way we operate that needs to change because we like our food the way it is.
Like past, like our mom's food, our grandma's food.
Wonton mee is wonton mee already. Don't go add truffle inside.
Thank you.
I don't know if anybody does it, but if somebody doing it, I mean, no offense. But
I don't know. I see truffles in everything.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Right? So it's this, or don't mix A and B and then call
another
it fusion.
Another mala. I see people add mala in everything this
Yeah,
says.
Mala I also do.
Yeah, but it's like
everything they do.
Mala yun tum mian.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So things like yeah, then it's when they call fusion, you know, this and that. I mean, don't get me wrong, these are interesting because if you were to argue, people would say that Singapore, our so-called traditional hawker food came about because there were fusion, because our forefathers came from different parts of China. You know, like our Hainanese chicken rice, it should not be called Hainanese chicken rice, right? It should be Singapore chicken rice. Because if you bloody go to Hainan, there's no such thing as the kind of chicken rice we have here because we have tailored it to suit our taste. And that only happens if people do fusion, you know, like, and then blah, blah, blah. So I'm not saying that they are wrong. I'm not saying that it's not good, but what I prefer to do is, we don't need to reinvent the food. We need to reinvent the way we run a hawker business. That's what I think. So, which is why when we came to my business, I want to adopt stuff that restaurants are already using. It could be a workflow. It could be equipment. And these things are actually very accessible. These are not new technology. I mean, induction, everybody knows what's an induction, but a lot of hawkers, you'll be surprised, don't, right? Or insulated boiler. If you guys must know, it's just a big pot, right? Like it holds 170 liters of whatever you put in it, but it's insulated. So it could be still a rolling warm. Boil inside. Yeah. But if you touch on the outside, it's lukewarm.
Yeah.
And once it's boiling, it shuts itself off. And because it's insulated, it keeps warm for 12 hours if you cover it, right? So it's very efficient and you don't get burns. Because if you look at the old school guys, right, they have a big stock pot.
Yeah.
And then they have a big burner at the bottom. And it's so hot, it's flames, it's dangerous. And if you touch your, you know, this parts, it's like you see a lot of chefs have all these burn marks because they when they leave the lid, the steam comes up and all that stuff. So all these things can change. And then this whole how to manage your entire workflow like a restaurant. I mean, a hawker store is essentially a mini restaurant kitchen.
Mm.
It is what it is. Mm. It is small, but it has everything that is
needed. Restaurant has, yeah,
there's a restaurant. Just in a small scale. So if you, you know, do all your first in, first out, have proper containers for every item, labeled and everything, then it makes it very systematic.
Hey, this is Eric here, just dropping in to check in on you. Are you getting value so far from this interview? Because if you are, I'm very happy for you. And I'm really curious to know what are some of the key takeaways. So after the interview, go to social media, screenshot your learnings and tag me, all right? So that we can connect. Okay. I'm going to leave you to listen to the rest of the interview. Enjoy.
And how does that benefit the hawker? Like when things are systematic and things have a workflow?
Then you become blistering fast.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I started doing 16 hours a day because I was so flustered. There's things everywhere. And I'm like, you need to get all this, declutter the whole damn thing, right? We got to make it very clean, very systematic. Get one pinch of this for one pinch of that. And then you make this, for example. And then I start making charts, right? Because I realized I can't do everything by myself, you know, and I need to make sure somebody else can do it when I'm not around. But then again, I have all this training as a cook. But this person might not know all these things. So to simplify it, you need to itemize everything and make it into a SOP, right? So it's the same concept. I mean, I'm doing for hawkers what McDonald's has done for fast food, what Henry Ford has done for cars.
Yeah.
Because back in the day when somebody wanted to assemble a car, it was two or three engineers and they spent 2 months to assemble a car. If you want to eat a burger in the 40s and 50s, you go to a burger joint, one chef assembles your entire burger. He sweats the onions, grills the buns, and grills the patty, assembles the burger. It takes a lot of time. And most importantly, it takes a lot of skill. You're skill dependent, right? But when Henry Ford went to see a slaughterhouse, I think that's how the story goes. I might be wrong, but I think that's how it went. He saw how they slaughtered cows and it was on a conveyor. So they dispatched the animal, dead, hanging upside down. One guy would drain the blood and then a guy would cut this and then cut. But everybody does one job. And by the end of that belt, it pops out a perfectly clean carcass, ready to go. So Henry Ford was like, wow, man, that's great. So instead of having two or three engineers, which is so difficult to hire because they're trained workers, I can now hire everybody. They don't need to know anything. They just need to know how to put this screw into this hole very quickly, very well, repetitively, every single day. And a whole line on these people. And they're not expensive because they're not skilled workers. Mm. And they're easy to find because anybody can do it.
Oh my God, I'm getting it now.
Yeah. So then that's what you want to do. Because if you want to have the product, like only I know how to do, then what if I'm sick?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what about my scalable?
Yeah,
exactly. Then what about my next store? Right. So then I just quickly, but that was already part of the plan. You know, the expansion is already part of the plan going in. So we simplified everything in the store and we managed to get from 16 hours a day down to, I think, 8 to 9 hours.
And wait, let's set a context. So 16 hours of work time, like a person had to produce X number of bowls, take 16 hours.
Yep.
Now for the same X number of bowls, you only take half the time.
Yep.
Wow.
Same number of bowls.
Save time means save money.
Save a lot.
Or the extra time can set up another store.
Yeah. So now my Telok Blangah store is like, guys, if you want to get the true Jia Song experience, you better go to the Telok Blangah store.
For sure.
Because the store is the real one, original. The two staff in there are mine, really, so-called my pioneer staff. Yeah. And that is the only store that is still 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then we sell out or we close for the day. The rest of the Bugis ones are, we run 13 hours operations, but we have two shifts of people.
Got it.
Mm. So you see, but because of that system I told you, it makes hiring easier. So when they interview and they say, I don't know, I don't have much experience doing this.
Doesn't matter.
I only have two questions and that were asked during interview. A, are you willing to learn? Of course. Everybody will say yes. B, can you cook instant noodles? If the answer is yes, then okay. Then we can talk.
I wanted to say can you follow instructions? It's not to follow your instructions to get a food. Yeah.
But then that's the nice part about this also because for example, when you're using induction and all that, you can set the temperature. It's not like gas, man. Gas, you got to turn, then you look at the flame or agar agar here.
Yeah.
But induction,
explain. Yeah. Agar agar means estimate.
Yeah,
right?
It's an estimation game, right? Yeah. Correct? You look at the flame or you put a marker, line follows.
So there's no consistency.
Yeah, but then depends on the outflow of the gas, isn't it? If you have a full canister, this marking is still stronger than if that canister was half dead. Right? Think about it. It's all this fluctuating, what's the word?
The little changes, right?
Yeah.
That makes all the
inconsistency
difference.
That's in it, So the variables, that's the thing. But with induction, 1,500 watts
is 1,500 watts.
For 3 minutes, ding, stop cooking, move.
This is beautiful. I've never seen a hawker business that way, right? But that's also the reason why restaurants can scale.
Yeah.
Because they have just one head chef, but they have a system.
Correct.
Right? That is replicable.
Correct.
So if a hawker can start thinking that way, number one, safety.
Yes.
Number two, maintenance of quality of food. Number three, they have the potential to scale their business and grow.
Correct. And be very efficient. That means we don't have any food wastage. Our food wastage is equivalent to zero.
Why do you say food wastage is zero?
Again, this is difficult to explain, but we par cook our stuff, right? So we take out what we need as we need them.
It's like in the factory world, we call it just in time. Just in time manufacturing. So I think it's the same thing. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you don't waste.
For example, if you're doing chicken rice, that's difficult because you have to think, today I want to sell 20 chickens. So you have to cook in the morning. And then maybe if you don't sell 20 chickens, you're going to have two guys, 18. Then I'm going to do the last two chicken, that kind of stuff. But we will never have this problem because we will take them out as we use them and it's prepped the day before, portioned nicely. Again, like I said, everything has its boxes. As we need to do this, of course, we plan, today 200, for example. Today, we want to sell 600 bowls. We prep for 600. But as we are going, looks like it's going to hit past 600. We have more because we prep 2 days. So two is one, one is none.
Yeah.
And so we will never run out. I mean, we will never run out A and B, we will never have food wastage.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So I hope the rest of you guys listening to this, I think this will be very powerful, not just for the F&B business, but for any business for that matter.
Yeah.
To think in terms of systems.
Correct. Correct.
Right? That can your business run when you're not even around?
Correct.
Can you still produce the same standard?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, before the interview, we were just casually talking a lot about the local food scene, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. What do you think are some of the frustrations right now today about the local food scene?
I have a couple of them. I mean, but to say across the entire F&B industry, I'll say the first one is labor, for example. That frustrates me because I think everybody knows this it's been a problem since day one that it's hard to hire. A lot of Singaporeans are not willing to do the job.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'll be honest, and this is my experience, Singaporeans, a lot of them very spoiled, very entitled. I literally have a girl came and said, I want to be a hawker and all that.
Yeah.
I said, may I know what is the pay you're expecting? Of course, I asked her experience. I've done a little bit in a cafe. So she's not very experienced, but I'm willing to teach. That's fine. And I asked her, how much are you expecting so that we're on the same level? Or, if you give me a number, I see whether I can meet you there.
Correct.
And she says 3,000. And I'm saying, excuse me, 3,000, is you giving to me or I'm giving to you? I mean, you have a no experience person coming and she's expecting and she said it in such a way as though 3,000 is really very minimum, huh? By the way, that kind of feeling. And then it's very disheartening. I'm like, oh, listen, girl, this is not a Michelin star restaurant, you're working in a hawker store. So it's a bit difficult to find labor. And of course, I feel that the certain rules and regulations also prevent a lot of people who want to come in, especially the hawker scene, for example. I shan't name the agencies, but I would say the government sectors that are governing this whole hawker scene makes it very, very difficult for young hawkers. I'll tell you, it's an uphill struggle. I will tell you that everything from the bidding system, I mean, if you want to get a store in a hawker center, you have to bid for it, right? It's like an auction, right? It's not ballot, my friend. Bid, that means you throw
in whoever gets the highest.
Yeah, exactly. The highest bidder wins, which I find extremely strange. I don't think it's right because if I'm not wrong, you know, these agencies are, they're not here to lose money, but they're not a profit-driven organization either. But what's the purpose of bidding or an auction, so to speak?
Correct.
Is to drive the price up, right?
And then the young entrepreneurs will not have the kind of capital, right?
Yeah, or they bite off more than they can chew.
Mm.
Right? Because it's, if other agencies were to follow this concept, then I, for example, HDB, I tell you, finish, if HDB allow bidding, I tell you the low-income family will got no house.
Homeless.
Yes, exactly. They will not be able to afford a house. But HDB have figured out that, you know, it should be based on fairness. And so they go for a ballot system, right? So it's the luck of the draw, right? I mean, if you get it, if you get it. And I think it should be this way. It should be more controlled. You shouldn't have so much red tapes. And of course, you know, the price has to go down. Because I'll tell you, and this is online, so I'm not disclosing anything, right? So if you go to the certain particular website to check the last successful bid for the past couple of months, there are some stores over at Tiong Bahru, right? That I think they bid for $5,000 or something like that.
For a hawker?
Yes. I'm not even joking. So this champion who bid this price, if he were to hire one staff, at least he has to at least hire one person, right? You know, I'd say, and you cannot hire foreigners.
Ah.
You got to hire Singaporeans. The Singaporeans are not going to work for anything less than $2,500. Let's say give her or him $2,500 plus CPF, maybe $2,800 to $2,900, right? Out of your pocket. And then you have to have your ingredients. You have to have your, we call it the siu wap, the conservancy, the one who kind of collect your bowls, right?
Yeah.
It's not free. And then if you want to engage somebody to wash your bowl offsite, that's another $900. Yada, yada, yada. Before he can roll out his shutter on the first day of his opening, he would have been 10,000 in the hole.
Mm.
Easily. Now, if you're selling mihun kueh, how many mihun kueh must you sell before you are even making a profit? That you have covered rent, overheads, you know?
Well, assuming your bowl is $3, 1,000, that's 300 bowls.
Yeah.
Oh my God, more than 333 bowls.
But you sell that sales, that's not profit. Think about it, my friend.
Yeah, and that's actually just break even only.
Correct. So that's why these people cannot shut down. They cannot have an off day. They cannot do half day work. They have to do a 8, 9 hours, 10 hour shift because they cannot close the shop. They need to make it happen. And after they do it for 6 months, they burn out. They're like, shit, I don't want this life no more, blah, blah, blah. So all this talk about supporting the hawker culture, UNESCO and all that. Yes, we want it. Everybody rah-rah, but after the fact, there is not enough support.
Mm.
You know, I'm a hawker mentor, right? This SID agency has done this thing called the Hawkers Development Program. I think it's very interesting. They give you an opportunity to learn from hawkers and they get guys like us to be mentors and we teach them.
Okay.
But after they teach them, they don't give them any opportunities to do anything.
Oh, it's just a learning thing.
Yeah, it's just a learning. Then there are some things like incubator stores that they offer. But these incubator stores are in places that the business will not survive. You know what I mean? They're like, you know, the armpit of Singapore, literally, one corner, obscure places. Or they even have places like, oh, it sounds very nice, Maxwell or Amoy Street, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
But excuse me, it's COVID.
Yeah, we're not working. We're all working from home.
You can't go into CBD now. These guys, you are setting them up to fail. And I'm saying this as a guy who has been through it, you know, so it's wrong. So this is one thing I really feel frustrated about, you know, the inability to hire foreigners. We can't find workforce and then all these red tapes that are making it so difficult for young hawkers who wants to come up. That's one of them. And I think a lot needs to be done to improve.
Mm.
And there's a lot of room for improvement. Let's just put it this way. And the other thing that I really have issue about, this is a little bit more personal. I don't know how to call it though. Let's call it the social media review culture.
Okay. Social media.
Or the review culture that surrounds F&B. Basically, you know, people writing reviews or people giving a comment or giving a rating.
Correct.
So I'm not talking about my store. So this is generally.
Yeah.
Because I personally have seen a lot of F&B establishments that I personally like. That means like certain wantan mee.
Yes.
Or I personally want them good. But then, you know, there are always the haters in it and all that. We are talking about these people. Okay. Who talks about all that. And why I think this is a problem, accountability.
Mm.
Okay, I feel. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against feedback. I love feedback. I treasure them, I appreciate them, but only if they fall into three very important categories. Food quality. Of course, if there's something wrong with the food, I need to know. Okay, thank you very much. I really want to know. Food hygiene.
Mm.
Okay, so if it's unsafe, something went wrong, I need to know.
Yeah.
Service. Right, so if it falls into any of these three categories, great.
Yeah.
These to me are feedback. But it becomes difficult when it goes into the personal realm, like my personal opinion, you know, because taste is a notoriously...
So subjective.
Subjective, exactly. What you like, somebody else might not. And when your review is based solely on your personal opinion, then it's very difficult to address.
Yep.
Right. But don't get me wrong. I think it is still okay if you are a professional in some ways. Say, for example, you are a food blogger, you are a food writer, or even just a chef, a real chef. I think that's still okay because to some extent, you know what you're talking about, right? And that's how it used to be because before the days of social media, food reviews are always in magazines or in newspaper.
Correct. By professionals.
Correct, by professionals. Yeah. Food writers, food people. But these guys, but now, these days, anybody who is anybody can comment.
Anybody with a phone and a social media account.
Correct, they can comment.
Yeah.
But my question is this, who are these people? For all we know, this guy can't even boil water to save his life, right? But they're commenting about food. That's akin to me telling Tiger Woods, that looks like a bad swing, bro. I could do this swing many times better than you. Tiger Woods turns around. So do you play golf? I never held a club in my entire life. But I know a bad swing when I see one. Does this sound fair?
Yeah, it doesn't sound fair because
if you don't know, you can't judge people. I feel sorry for a lot of these F&B establishments because when they do that, I mean, if it's an opinion, fine. But if they start to give reviews, what it actually does is, or give a star rating on Google, for example, it actually affects someone's business.
100%, because as a consumer, we actually do look at reviews.
Exactly.
But we will not question the review.
Correct. So it affects someone's business. It undermines people's hard work that they put in just because of your own misplaced judgment. Okay. And of course, I can tell you a lot of stories. I mean, you just tried my food today, right? Okay, let's talk about me then. There was once a person who wrote in and said that, your soup is disgusting. It has a burnt taste. I think your chef must have overfried the ikan bilis. I'm saying this, if that person is watching this, I'm talking to you, right? you know, the chef must have burnt the ikan bilis. That's why it had this burnt, disgusting taste. It's very bad. You should ask him to watch out, you know? Not knowing that this wok hei
was intentional.
Yeah, it is intentional and it's the specialty of the store.
Yeah.
It's like you walking into a sushi restaurant and complain that the meat is raw. I mean, you know, so you need to know what you're eating before you go and shove it down your throat. That's one. B, the moment you talk about ikan bilis being over-fried and then creating this char taste that is this wok hei, right? You know for a fact this person has not a blinking clue about food or how it's done. Because I can tell you, darling, it's a lady, I can tell you, darling, if you can get wok hei out of over frying your ikan bilis, you need to bottle that up because you'll be a millionaire. You need to sell it by the gram. So these are the people who are making these comments.
Yeah.
And that's just me. But when I read other food establishments, I feel very sorry for them. You know, like, oh man, because I know for a fact that they are really good. And this particular person just has a different opinion.
Yeah.
And I feel sorry for them because it's embarrassing. They think that by going against the grind, they feel like maybe they're very opinionated. Yeah. But that's not. Because if everybody likes something and you're the only one who doesn't, chances are you are the weird one, right? It's the same saying, right? You can't find the asshole in the room, it's probably you.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I don't think it's healthy. So I don't think these people should comment so much. I mean, think about some established. I mean, if it's within the three categories.
Exactly. The three things that you just mentioned.
I agree. But if it's just, I feel it's not nice, I won't go back. I won't encourage anybody to go back. I don't think you need to say all these things because somebody worked hard, you know? And most importantly, last but not least, I don't recall anybody asking for their opinion. Because if somebody posts a picture of their food, for example, and I've seen this, and they're just proud, man, oh, this is our food. It's no different from you putting a picture of, say, an art piece that you've done, or your child,
your
baby, or, you know. But you know what they say about babies, right? Sometimes in the eye of the mother, it's
correct,
the cutest.
Yeah.
But that picture of somebody's food, somebody's artwork, or somebody's baby, is just them sharing what they are proud of. They are not asking for an opinion. When you come along and say, that's an ugly ass painting, man. Or, you know, that bowl is so, I tasted it that day, it's so bad, I didn't want to eat it again. I mean, how would you feel if I look at a picture of your baby and say, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen in my damn life? You know, it's just rude, right?
So you know, that's the thing that I feel that social media is a double-edged sword.
Correct.
Right.
Exactly.
Just like you said, MasterChef, is that yes, we are given a platform.
Correct.
All of us given a platform. But we need to practice discernment
correct.
In our because words have power.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
life and death.
Exactly.
Well, that's very powerful. I mean, okay, I'm in the social media world. I mean, we do sometimes get, like, we will share what we feel about experiences, but it's very nice to hear from your point of view that, hey, every single word that you say, you know, can uplift a person mm-hmm. or can bring a person down, which is why there's a saying that if you have a chance to be kind or to be right, always choose to be kind.
Yeah.
And especially in today's world.
Exactly. And that doesn't cost you anything to not say certain things, for example. Don't punch down at people.
Or another way to do it is public compliment, mm-hmm. private criticism.
That's the way to go.
So if I really think your ikan bilis is even, I mean, there's no basis for that. But even if
something
she comes from
wrong,
a good place,
yeah.
you see, you think about it. If she has come from a good place,
yeah.
she would have understand that a business is tough.
Exactly.
I'm going to still give you a good rating. I will say what I like.
Mm-hmm.
But the part about the burn, I'll message you privately.
Exactly.
And I say, dude, your thing is burnt. And you would have been very kind to educate her.
I would reply nicely.
Yeah.
For sure. And I do 100% of that. If they reach out to the privately in the post,
yes, exactly.
ask about certain things, we will always address. But these are the people, but when I'm talking about these people, I'm talking about the one-star people.
Yeah, we talk intention. I yeah. always think that it's yeah. about, words is words, but what's the intent when you say all the things?
Correct. And some of them, are unfortunately, I mean, it happened in, what's that one called? TripAdvisor many
yes,
years back,
okay.
right? When they were not accountable. So people are writing all kinds of, like different hotels trashing
yeah,
each other.
Yeah, they essentially yeah. hire writers
yeah,
to write.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
So then I think they did something like you need to show proof of stay and all that stuff.
Correct.
And then have accounts so that people know who you are.
Yeah.
You know, you are reachable, you're contactable.
Correct.
That's why you're accountable for what you say. So they clean up TripAdvisor pretty okay. That's what I understand.
Because more trusted.
Correct. But these guys, I tell you, man, I'm going to share another story. There was this lady who wrote in privately that our portions are very small. It's not enough for her. So when you write to me privately, it's my basic decency
yeah,
to respond. And I say, I'm sorry you feel this way, but what you must know is our kuih, right? If you have seen it in a store, it's pre-cut
yeah.
to a certain size.
Yeah.
It's about 120 grams. If you eat a bak chor mee, bak chor mee is noodles,
some
basic
noodles, yeah.
minced pork noodles, it's 100 to 110 grams. Okay. If you got a bowl of bak chor mee, it's like
yeah.
that, or wonton mee is like this. But ours is 120, so it's really more. Okay. So we're actually serving you more than what you will get from a standard noodle shop. But however, it's good to know that if you want more, you can always add noodles. Like a dollar, you get more, like upsize, like, you know, upsize, supersize my mung kuih. But I think the word I used was if you are a bigger eater, that's what I use. Eh? So however, if you are a bigger eater, you'll be happy to know you can add noodles.
Yeah,
that's
upsize.
All I said.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I said. This lady took offense that the word bigger eater, and she is offended because it wasn't a standard. So I'm so sorry, we'll try to do better. You know, the cream and proper, the goody two shoe, politically correct answer. But
yeah.
I don't think I answered her wrongly. And what she did after that was completely crazy. So she went with her friend, right? She said, me and my friend went, blah, blah. And her friend left us, because this whole conversation is a private
conversation, yeah.
Left us a review on Google with a 1-star. And she said there clearly, we tried to contact the owner, but they were so rude and didn't want to take our feedback.
So rude?
Yes.
That's not rude.
Hmm?
That's just telling reply.
Yeah. So she said that we suggested that she's big lah, or whatever. Lah. I can't stand people who are extremely opinionated but easily bruised, you know?
You know, actually, Aaron, you really rightfully mentioned something. You see, today we I mean, the whole title of this show is about how to market a brand. And I've learned from you that you jolly well better make sure your food tastes good.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. But there's a lot of external forces as well. I mean, the regulation, that's when we talk about it, right? And learning how to create a system. But actually, our food can live and die by reviews.
Yes, yes, yes. I've seen people get cancelled because of, you know, some stuff they said. So
how can we protect ourselves? So if we're going to start a brand...
I think it's just you need to be zen as hell, right? You just need to just focus on your work and make sure you churn out quality stuff. That way, you're kind of bulletproof, right? Because you got to make sure you got yourself covered and make sure your food is good. Then you know you are okay in a good spot. Anybody who doesn't like it, like I said, is a personal taste, right? But if anybody who wants to put you down for the sake of putting you down, I think you just need to know when to just, you know, you can't please everybody.
And just to add on to what you say, right, there's this rule that there will always be 10% of the market that will love you for who you are, whatever you do.
Mm-hmm.
But there will also be a 10% who will hate you regardless of how hard you try. The magic is in the 80% that who are sitting on the fence, and your job is just to win them over.
That's nice.
And that's good enough.
Yeah, that's good enough.
So, another point to also add is I've interviewed somebody who teaches about mental wellness. She says this to me. She said that whenever you receive criticism, it's like Velcro to your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when you receive compliment, it's like Teflon in your mind. It slips away. So we tend to remember the negative more. And I guess what you just said to us is that there will be, but we need to understand that there are a few, but if we keep focusing on it, it amplifies.
Yep. And the first few is going to hit you pretty hard because it's, but once you get used to it, I mean, it's like any celebrities, right? When they first having people say stuff about them, I'm sure it affects them as well.
Yeah.
Their publicists will say, don't you dare reply. But after a while, they probably get used to it. And then, like you said, you can't win everybody over. Yeah. The haters will hate, but just concentrate on doing a good job, you know, which is why you're here. And just make sure you don't fall on your end, which is producing bad stuff. You know, like if your food is really bad, then you really have to work on it. So listen to that. Pick the advice that you want to listen to. Pick the feedback that you want to listen to.
I love that. And also the source of the feedback.
Yeah, correct. You know, you need to filter some of this stuff. If not, it drives you insane, man.
I love that. Oh my God. That's a great way to kind of put a pause to our interview. Yeah. Do you know what? It's so nice chatting with you. It's so easy.
Yeah.
Like, you're very well spoken.
Okay. For Abing, not bad. I
saw on the internet, people call you the Abing chef, right?
Yeah.
But you're very well spoken and it's been very enjoyable talking to you.
I don't know. Maybe I just watched a lot of shows.
A lot of shows.
I mean, I don't even have O-levels. So I don't know how I got this way, but yeah, but.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
in closing, so I just want to drop in two fun facts about our guest today, Aaron. Mm-hmm. So you don't see him, you know, like he is a chef, he's been master chef. But do you guys know that he's actually a commercial photographer? And I found out that he was actually featured on BBC, for crying out loud, as the wildlife photographer of the year.
Mm.
He has dived with sharks and crocodiles, even wrote two books on underwater diving. In fact, he has a shark tattoo on himself. Right. So, as a final question, has these two passion played a part in your entire culinary success?
I think one thing is photography has taught me to be very particular about details. The devil is in the details, right? Creative people. I mean, if you are not at least a little bit OCD, you have no business being in the creative industry. Think about it. If something that is obviously ugly as hell is okay to you, then you have no business being in this industry.
Okay.
So being a photographer, you know, being a director, DOP and all that, we are looking at light, you know, very precise things. We zoom in 100 times and look at small little thing, you know, can we fix this hair? Can we do that? You know, can we try this look again? Can we, you know, we're always improving and very particular. So I think that attention to details is what helps me a lot in this F&B. Although I know it sounds very far apart, but if you look at the mi hun kuih, especially having eaten it just now, right, you realize that every single component has love in it. For example, the broth, we all know. The noodles, hand torn, we know. The bak chor. The bak chor is a very, by the way, it's their thing, right? Nobody actually put a lot of effort into bak chor. A lot of
bak chor, explain, English.
Bak chor means mincemeat.
Ah, mincemeat.
Mincemeat on the top of the noodles.
The small mincemeat.
Nobody really care much about it. It's usually just boiled in the soup and thrown on top of the noodles. But if you eat our bak chor, our mincemeat, it's very tender. It's been brined. It's been seasoned. The meat slice, the pork slices, which again is like people just boil it and then pop on. That's it. Get out of here. Ours is very tender. Again, brined and seasoned. So each component is good enough on its own. That's what we want to do, right? Every single component. It's on its own, a rock star. So that's the attention to details. I think what I'm trying to explain, like every little thing. So same thing for the branding, same thing for how the store looks. You know, my ops manager is not one such person. He's a operation guy. So he bought a pink color mop. I nearly died.
Why?
Because then he's like, but why? It's a mop. I said, but the entire kitchen is stainless steel.
Yeah, it's suddenly gone pink.
Yeah. If it's not black, white,
gray
or silver, it should not be in here.
Nice. Okay.
Then he asked, then I look at him, do you see a pink color mop in Din Tai Fung's kitchen? When you can see his glass,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You see in Din Tai Fung's kitchen?
Yep.
No. So please, take it home. So that's the photographer director speaking, okay. Not the chef. And it says,
yes.
Oh, I want things this way.
Attention to detail. Yeah. Very big.
Maybe a bit difficult to swallow in the beginning, but once you get a hang of it, I mean, people around you, then they know how you work and the results that comes along, then they understand why it needs to be done this way.
And the passion for sharks. What about that? You are extremely, so passionate, you have a shark on you. And you are also involved, you're a pioneer and ambassador of an anti-shark finning campaign.
Yes.
And I see very popular people like Jackie Chan, yes. Maggie Q.
That's a crazy story that I would like to share.
Please.
I mean, using your platform to at least give a message. And every time I have an opportunity to talk about sharks, I would do it. I've been a diver for 20 odd years. I've been going out to sea all my life, right? As a child, I'd be fishing, you know, just happy to be in the ocean. Sharks, I would tell you right now, are the most misunderstood creatures. One of the most misunderstood ones. And the problem is this, why are sharks so important in the ocean? Because sharks are the apex predators, right? You know, if you learn in school,
the triangle,
pyramid of life and all that stuff. So the apex predator plays a very important role because everything else is in line with them, right? They need to weed out the weak ones and, you know, all these things, natural selection, yada, yada. So that's what sharks do. And if you take away the apex predator of any ecosystem, it's going to have devastating effect, right? And, you know, this Dr. Sylvia Earle, which is a very famous biologist, once said that, you know, no blue, no green. Because whether we like it or not, our planet is 71% ocean. It's strange that we call her Mother Earth when she's so much water, right? To give you an idea of how much water that is, you can take all the continents on Earth, squeeze them together, throw them in the Pacific Ocean, you still have another 10 to 20% of ocean left to spare. That's how much ocean there is. More man has gone to the surface of the moon than people have gone to the bottom of the ocean. So we know so very little about it and we need to protect it because it is the lungs of our planet. It creates all this water that we drink. It nurtures the rainforest that cleans our air and everything. The whole thing is the ocean. And sharks play a very important role. And the problem why it's important for us as Asians because we are the bunch of monkeys who are destroying them.
Shark fin soup.
We are talking about 70 million sharks a year, slaughtered, okay? Not for the whole carcass, not for their meat, just for their fins. A lot of the times, they are cut off alive and they're thrown back into the ocean.
Yeah, and
I
heard it's very cruel because sharks actually breathe by moving.
Exactly,
fin, no, I read, my sister is a diver. So,
exactly.
It's f***ing cruel.
Yeah, so they actually drown. That's what's happening because sharks, unlike a lot of most species of sharks, not all sharks, doesn't have that muscle in the gills that pumps water like a regular fish. So in order to breathe, they are always swimming. When they swim, they open their mouth and the water basically goes in and it aerates the gills and that's how they breathe. But without their fins, they can't do that and they sink. And as they're sinking, a lot of fish will peck away at the wounds that were the fins. And basically, they will sink to a point whereby, you know, the pressure itself will destroy this animal. And it's just very cruel. And all this for a bowl of soup that is completely useless. Because shark fin is actually cartilage. It has the nutritional value of your nails because you can chew your nails and it'd be the same thing.
It doesn't add any taste to the shark fin soup.
No, it doesn't.
Anyway,
it's the broth that gives the taste.
Yeah.
If anything, when we eat shark fin soup, we always add vinegar, right?
Yeah.
And you know how that tradition came about? Because sometimes we swallow bone, right? In the old days, you drink vinegar to soften it. Yeah. That's how it came about.
Mm.
Because the original shark fin is cartilage. It's stingray, you know the stingray soft bone.
Correct.
Same thing, stingray and sharks are the same family. So if you eat stingray and this whole piece of thing, and you chew it or you dry it in the sun, and then you boil it in the broth, that's shark fin soup. That's the same component. But because of that, we murder 70 million each year out of profit and fear, and the misinformation, and people think sharks are dangerous. And I'll tell you, I've dived to sharks, thousands upon thousands of sharks. I've been to Fakarava, that's a real place. In French Polynesia, it's called Fakarava.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's one of the largest concentration of sharks in one channel. You dive with thousands of sharks. I fed 4-meter tiger sharks this close. And I will tell you now, if these guys were man-eating monsters of the movies, I won't be sitting here with you guys, man. I mean, he farts, I die. You know, he doesn't have to do anything. He's an apex 4-meter of pure muscle with a very mean business end. And, you know, I don't feel threatened at all. These guys clearly know we are not the food. They are smart. They are not stupid. They have feelings. They have characters. I'll tell you, a couple of years back, I shot for a shelter, a pet shelter for dogs, right? And I came out, I didn't come out with the idea, I suggested that, you know, we should take pictures of all these dogs up for adoption. so that, you know, nice portrait, so that
people will adopt
them. So I went to this shelter. I kid you not, when I went into the shelter, and a lot of these dogs are mistreated, right? They're abused dogs. They're Singapore specials. They're big boys. And they have a fear of humans. So when I went in, some of them growling, and I'm in a cage with this big animal, right? And I'm more afraid, I'm more nervous with these. And I know dogs, I've had dogs all my life, but with these dogs, I'm like, shit, man, you know, it's a bit dangerous. You know, you got to be careful here, right? With the sharks, man.
Wow, what an irony.
Yeah, it's an irony, and people say that they are.
I think Jaws kind of ruined it for us.
Yeah, I mean, Spielberg has famously said if he had a choice to go back in time to fix one thing, he wouldn't make Jaws. Yeah, 1976.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think that was the reason.
We're going to need a bigger boat. That's what. But Jaws, yeah, it created fear in a whole generation that went on, and just people thinking that sharks are just out to
kill. Man-eating animals.
Yeah. But even if they were, let's just put it this way, it is their home. It's not like they came onto the beach, grab you and pull you in, you know. You went into the water. And who are the people who always get into trouble? I'm going to say this, if I have surfer friends, I'm sorry. But they're always the surfer, the spear fishermen. These are the two main groups of people who get into trouble with sharks. And you ask me why it happens, let me ask you a simple question. What is, for example, great white sharks and maybe tiger sharks, right? They have problems with the surface. Why? Now think about it. What is the main prey item for great white shark? Seals, sea lions, right? You know, these guys. Now, if you are a surfer, on the surface, you're on a cigar-shaped board and you have your hands on the side.
It looks like a seal.
Yeah. And you must understand there is no knowledge in instinct. If you throw a ball, the dog will chase it.
Yes.
Why the dog chase a ball? What is he going to do with the ball? He doesn't know what to do with it. He brings it back to you, throw it again. But why does he like it? Because it's the chase. And he has gotten it, your dog has gotten it from the ancestry days of being a wolf, hunting a rabbit or a rodent or whatever. So you throw the ball, it chases. What does it do with the ball? It doesn't really know. A shark, there's no knowledge in instinct. When they see something dart across, looks like a prey item, they go for it. They bite it. And the truth is, a lot of these surfers survive, right? They swim back. Maybe they lose an arm or leg. It's very morbid. Those who don't survive, usually because they bled out. Right, the arteries are cut, and then
because the shark bite and realize it's not, and then the shark just left.
Yeah, because if the shark had wanted to finish you and eat you as food, he would swim around and he will wallop you down one go, and you won't even get a body, right? Mm. You just get a piece of surfboard or wetsuit neoprene floating around. But most people, or at least the bodies, are recovered. They die after the trauma, bled out, but not consumed. Very few that I know of is consumed entirely. You couldn't find the guy. So it's all a case of mistaken identity for the actual attacks. But again, like I said, we're in their home. You know, we can't just go to a rainforest in Borneo and say bloody orangutans shouldn't live here.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yep.
And I will say protect all the animals, even the not so cute ones. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to hide behind the panda. Oh, you're so cute. The dolphins. Yeah. The tunas. But when you see a shark, there's teeth and all that. It's bad. So all the animals have the right to live there. They're here for a reason.
Wow, this is beautiful. I'm so glad I asked you that question. I mean, it's totally not related to our topic, but I just thought that that's a part of you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to enjoy some of the pictures later to, you know, Aaron brought two books.
So with the Finnish and with Finns thing, it's very interesting as well. Because when I'm as a photographer, I wanted to do a campaign, right? I want to do something. And then I realized at the time, a lot of the shark awareness campaigns are always showing all the facts, like a bloody shark, like shark fin, blood, you know, gore. And I just realized as an advertising photographer, people tend to shy away from blood and gore. Most people, normal people, okay? In the end, in advertising, there's two things that sell, sex and beauty. So think about it. What does a certain singer has to do with Pepsi, for example, or Coke?
Mm.
Nothing, you know? But if this guy drinks it, maybe I should.
Yeah, right? By association.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of people that needs to understand these things are not people like you and I, because we are well-informed about sharks. But people we need to convince are people like my folks, you know, who have never been to the ocean, or people who never relate to the ocean, let alone a shark. So, but if they can't relate to a shark, they can at least relate to Jackie Chan.
Mm.
So I came up with the idea of we're going to do a series of black and white pictures. And it started locally with a few. If I remember, I think Gurmit Singh was one of the first few guys. Then when we shot that, I said, it's going to be black and white. Cover your mouth any way you want it. I don't care. But show your character, who you are. So we did a few pictures with some of the so-called artist friends that I have worked with over the years. And so they just did whatever they do. So, and then we came up with this idea called Finished with Fins. fin niche with fins. And then we came out with the first few pictures, and then it kind of had a momentum of its own. So other artists saw it and they wanted to get involved.
Part of it. Yeah.
And so we have all the A-listers. We have Zoe, you know, some people we can't because of certain agreements with other brands, but everybody basically came along, and then it went to Taiwan. And then we had, we worked with corporate companies. So like DHL, even the boss, like the CEO of the region came down and said that anything that they, of the function, or any, you know, D&D or things that they ship around, will not have shark fin. And then hotels came along, Hilton. So we have all these corporate people who came as well, athletes, politicians. Then he went to Taiwan, and I still went to Taiwan to shoot. But then I realized it got very big, and I can't do. I mean, I would like to shoot all these celebrities, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not about me or my portfolio. So I said, you know, to make it work, I need to give it to somebody, and I handed it over to Shark Savers, who is a proper NGO. And then they allocate whoever is there in that country to shoot it.
Local photographers.
Yeah, with this template that we have. And then that's how we got to Jackie Chan and then...
Maggie Q.
Yeah, a lot of folks. And I kind of stepped back and think, it's become bigger than me. So then I just let it do its stuff. But over the years, shark fin consumption in Asia has dropped by almost 70%. Yeah.
You know, in closing, my final question to you is this, like everything you touch seemed to grow. You know, your photography, and then you got featured in BBC, and then the shark thing, the shark campaign, it grew to a global phenomenon. And then you cooking, got into MasterChef, now you have 6 stores. What do you think is that one thing that secret, I mean, we talk about secret sauce, but is there that one thing that you have that allow you to be able to have this minus touch?
I think without a doubt, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because people repeat it enough for it to become
like first principle. What would that be?
I would say the key word is passion, because you can't shit yourself with all this. You can't bullshit your way through it. You cannot do anything well if you're not passionate about it. If it's just a job, then you're just going to do your job. And there's a lot of people, even my friends, say, I love my job. I think it's a bit overrated when they say it. I would say you like your job. You don't necessarily love your job. My first question would be, if your boss says, I'm not going to pay you no more, would you show up for work? And you, most people say, hell no, of course not. Then you don't love your job. Because if I'm not paid, I'd be still taking photographs. I'd still be cooking. Maybe not for people, but I'd still be cooking. That's passion. That's what you mean by, I love my job. You don't love your job, you kind of like it enough. So the point is, find what you like and make it into a business for yourself. I'm sure you enjoy what you are doing.
I love it.
Yeah. Exactly, right? And even if I say, I'm not going to pay you no more, you'll still be doing a lot of these things for whatever reason, just in case somebody wants to watch it, somebody wants to listen, because that is you. This is your stage. This is your passion. So if you find it, whatever it is, then go for that one.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. That is... Aaron, all right. I'm going to call him Shark Boy next time.
All right. Baby. Better than Mi Hun Kuih Boy, I guess.
Thank you so much. And I sincerely wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
You do. And hopefully one day we get to see more young people in the hawker scene.
Yes.
And that, you know, everyone supports this culture. Yes, because hawker is a very big part of us.
Correct. Just a shout out, Damien, as in, like, if you guys out there want to get into the hawker scene and you guys really inspired and really want to learn and do something, come talk to me. I can give you advice. Or if you want to join our team, you can learn a lot of stuff from us. Just reach out to us in our Facebook.
Awesome. I will collect all your social media handles in my show notes. But give us one right now. What's the easiest? I mean, I guarantee there'll be people who reach out to you or tag this interview. You know, how do they reach out to you to say thank you for this?
Okay. If it's just going to be for the hawker stuff, then you just go to Jiasong.
JIAKSONG.
Yeah.
Okay.
For me, if you want to ask about photography or some personal advice, it's really just me, then it's AaronWong.sg on IG.
Or you just hang out in Telok Blangah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Hope to see you again. Cheers.
Cheers, buddy.
If you love this episode, remember to hit the follow button on Spotify or the plus button on Apple Podcasts.
#highly sought after.